I'll share my screen. You asked about the picture. So the picture, this is a picture that I took myself about 5 years ago, almost exactly 5 years ago, in Romania. That's the kever, and the mausoleum in the center is the kever of Rav Yecheskel Paneth, the Mar Yecheskel. And I didn't realize it when I took the picture, but the picture was just so striking. And you had, you saw that for some reason, that path to that grave is just more well-worn than the rest of the cemetery, that it actually, you had this image of a path through the graveyard. So I sort of, first of all, I printed it, and it hangs now in my living room, but I also now made it my, you know, the title of this third part of this series is A Path Through the Graveyard. And because that's what this is about, I have this picture, which I think, to me anyway, it looks like a path through a graveyard. In a little while, we'll get to why I call this here that. So, back to our Gemara. Where we left off, when we last saw our friends, Rashbi and his son, they had just left the cave after a second stint in the cave. Now, caves come up in stories, and sometimes a cave is just a cave. I alluded to this a little bit last week. Sometimes a cave is just a cave. Sometimes it's not just a cave. Now, I live in Modi'in, and near to my house, really just a few minutes away from my house, I can find caves that were dug in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, dug in the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt. They're all over the place here. And as I pointed out in the first week, this area is where the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai took place. It took place at Yavne. There's even a Bereshit Rabbah talks about the cave being in Pekiin, but Pekiin in the south, not in the north. Pekiin in the area, really not far from Modi'in. So when Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai runs to the cave, there are people that really try to find the symbolism in that. But I think that to the extent that we can say things like this about, you know, it's impossible really to get out, to get to the history of the story, behind the story. But in this era, in this part of the world, a cave is really not, it's ubiquitous. The whole country is filled with caves that were used as hiding places. But that's only for the first part, their first stint in the cave. The first stint in the cave, the first 12 years, the cave was a hiding place. Then they leave the cave and they come back. When they come back into the cave at God's instruction, they're not in the cave in order to keep themselves away from the world, because the world's out to get them. It's for the world's sake. They're out to get the world. They're burning it up. And so Hashem says to them, the Bakul says to them, go back to the cave. Time out. Go back to your cave. And here, the cave actually does function as a, as a landscape that is outside the world, outside of human society. So they leave the cave. And what happens? No, they go out. Kol Heifa to have a Machi Rabbi Elazar, have a Masi Rabbi Shimon. Wherever Rabbi Elazar would hurt, would harm, would wound, Rabbi Shimon would heal. Right? So whereas the first time they left the cave, they would both burn everything up. Here, Rabbi Elazar is still burning things up, but Rabbi Shimon is healing. There's some sort of static that I'm getting. Is there somebody that's not muted? Because there's like some really bad
It's fine on my end. I don't know about other people, but it's fine with me. I don't know. Everybody.
There are a half dozen people who are not muted on the list, on the participants
so
list.
Let me mute everybody again. Okay, here's what I'm going to do. It may take a second to get Rabbi Fisher back. I'm going to mute everybody. You will not be able to unmute yourself. We're going to mute you. So no one will be able to unmute yourself. It may mute you, Rabbi Fisher. I'm not sure, but then I can go in and, add you. Okay, so let me just do that. Okay. Okay, Rabbi, you should be able to speak. Okay, so everybody should be muted. Nobody will be able to mute. Maybe right at the end of the class we can unmute people. You can put all your questions like usual in the chat box, but now it should be fine. Rabbi, why don't you speak to make sure we can hear you, but you should be okay.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
Okay. Okay, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Great. Okay. So Rabbi Eliezer is destroying, Rabbi Shimon is healing. Omar lo, and Rabbi Shimon says to his son, Bini, my son, Dai l'olam aniva ata. You and I are enough for this world. Now, this is also a quote of another Gemara. I don't want to dwell on it. It's from Sanhedrin, I believe, where Rabbi Shimon, it sounds like a very arrogant statement. You and I are enough for this world. But in light of what we've seen, I think that it's actually somehow world-affirming that Rabbi Shimon said, there's no purpose for this world. We're gonna burn this world up. What we call Chaye Olam is the only thing that's important, and we're going to condemn anything that's Chaye Sha'a. And now he's saying, you and I are enough for this world. So I don't know if he's saying that, look, this world produced us. That means that obviously there's potential for Chaye Olam within Chaye Sha'a. Or if he's saying that it's enough that we exist, that we can justify the entire existence of the world, right? Our zechut, however that works, is enough for the whole world. It is in some weird way, it's life affirming, it's world affirming. And then we come to what I think is the most powerful part of this story. Hade panya de male shabta. As the sun set on Erev Shabbat, Chazu hahu saba dehava nakit tre madane asa. They saw an old man who was holding two branches of myrtle. Virahit, he was running bein hashmashot during the twilight, during bein hashmashot. Amrule, they said to him, Hani lamalach. What are those for? Amar Lohu, he said to them, L'chvod Shabbat. They're in honor of Shabbat. And so they respond, they say back to him, Itizgilach l'chad, why isn't one enough? And so the old man answers them, Chad keneged Zachor, l'chad keneged Shamor. One corresponds to Zachor, and one corresponds to Shamor. These are the dual aspects of Shabbat. We say in Lecha Dodi, Zachor v'Shamor v'Dibur Echad, Shamor v'Zachor v'Dibur Echad. And those were in the first Luchot, the first recounting of the Decalogue in Sefer Shemot. The mitzvah of Shabbat starts off with the word Zachor. In the second set of Luchot, in Parshat Vayetchanan, it begins with the word Shamor, Zachor and Shamor. We're going to look at the Gemara, how the Gemara understands the relationship between Zachor and Shamor in just a second. But I don't want to get ahead of ourselves just to explain. One is Zachor, one is Shamor. This is what Zachor and Shamor are, two aspects of Shabbat. Omar le libre. And at this point, Rabbi Shimon says to his son, Chazi kamav chavivin mitzvot al Yisrael. You see how beloved the mitzvot are to Israel? Yativ da'atayu. His mind was put at ease. what's going on here? You have, it's a bizarre scene, right? Imagine they're walking and wherever they're walking, and they see an old man running. So first of all, the idea of an old man running is kind of comical. I don't like to think of myself as an old man, and when I run, it could be kind of comical. So if you're talking about somebody that's really an old man, then, you know, it's funny to see old men running, right? They're holding up their pants, they're whatever. And then you have this question of, you know, what are the myrtle branches for? He says, oh yeah, those are for Shabbos, the Chavad Shabbos. And I said, why do you need two? Like, one for Zohar, one's for Shamor. And I say, ah, beautiful. And now their minds are put at ease. They just spent 13 years in a cave. They've been refugees from the law. What is it, not just about Shabbat, but about the fact that there were two myrtle branches on Shabbat, that it wasn't just one myrtle branch that sets their minds at ease? We suggested that the crux of Rashbi's problem is this conflict between Chaye Olam and Chaye Shah. There's eternal life available to us by doing mitzvot, by learning Torah. There's eternal life that's available to us in this world. And yet we turn away from it and we engage in matters of temporal life. We plant and we plow. We produce food for ourselves. We produce clothing for ourselves. We build our homes. We engage in society. Those are Chaye Sha'a. And by participating in them, we neglect Chaye Olam. And Rashbi can't tolerate that. Shabbos is something of a paradox. The Gemara in Shavuot talks about the relationship between Zohar and Shamor, the relationship between the first and the second Luchot. And it brings a braita that says, Zohar v'Shamor b'dibur echad ne'emru. Zohar and Shamor were stated in one utterance. God only said one thing, but it refracted in our ears into two things. We heard two things. We heard Zohar v'Shamor. But God didn't say two things. God said one thing. Masha'ein ha'peyachol ledaber. This is impossible for human mouths. Masha'ein ha'ozen yachol lishmoa. And our ears can't hear when one utterance makes two sounds, says two things. Now, what's the upshot of this? So Hashem said both of these things in one utterance. Who cares? B'dibor echad ne'emru k'der of Adabar Ava. And that teaches us what Adabar Ava taught. What did Adabar Ava taught? Damar Rav Ava or Adabar Ava. Nashim chayavot b'kiddush hayom. Women have an obligation to make kiddush. Kiddush hayom. Devar Torah, according to the Torah. The Amarkra, because the Pasuk said, the Torah said, Zohar v'Shamor, said both Zohar and Shamor. Kol sheyeshno b'shmira, yeshno b'zchira. Anyone that's included in Shmira is also included in Zechira. Bahani nashi, hoel v'itnuhu b'shmira, women, since they are included in Shmira, Shomer Shabbat, itnuhu nami b'zchira, they're also included in the mitzvah of Zechira Shabbat. Even though, normally we would say that a mitzvah like Kiddush is a mitzvah taseh shehazman grama, that women are exempt from. When it comes to Shabbos, we don't say that. Why? Because Zohar v'Shamor b'dibur echad ne'emru, and anyone that's included in Zohar is included in Shamor. Everyone included in Shamor is included in Zohar. Okay. So first of all, it's understanding Zohar and Shamor as what we would call the negative aspects, the mitzvot lo taseh of Shabbat, and the mitzvot aseh of Shabbat. That Kiddush is one of the mitzvot aseh of Shabbat. And the mitzvot lo ta'aseh are the melachot, and women are always included in mitzvot lo ta'aseh. But it's saying that it's not that there are two separate mitzvot here. It's not that there's a set of mitzvot lo ta'aseh. that you have to observe on Shabbat. And there's a set of mitzvot aseh that you have to observe on Shabbat, saying that these two sides of Shabbat, the positive and the negative, the omission and the commission, are really two sides of one coin. There's Shabbos is one thing. Shabbos isn't two things. Shabbos is one thing. Shabbos is Shabbos. It's refracted. It breaks into our, when we attempt to understand Shabbos, it breaks down in our minds, in our ears, in our mouths, into two separate aspects. There's the aspect of Shamor and the aspect of Zachor. There's the aspects of the positive things that we do for Shabbat, like Kiddush, and then there's the aspects of the things that we refrain from on Shabbat, which are the 39 categories of labor, the 39 milachot. And because Shabbos is only one thing, it makes no sense to say that if you're included in this, you're included in this part of Shabbat, you're not included in that part of Shabbat. No, Shabbos is a whole. So if women are commanded to keep Shabbat, then they're also commanded in Zachor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho, because this is not a mitzvah aseh shehazman grama. It's not a it's a mitzvah aseh and it's mitzvah lo ta'aseh all wrapped up into one, because Zachor v'Shamor b'dibur echad ne'emru. Now, in a certain sense, this reflects a paradox of Shabbos. Shabbos is a paradox in the sense that Shabbos is part of, but frame it as a question. Is Shabbos part of the week, or is Shabbos transcendent, something that's completely different, completely other? It's not part of the week. Well, there are certain aspects. The answer is that Shabbos is both. That Shabbos is both in time and outside of time. Shabbos is outside of time in the sense that all of the things that we do in time, we stop on Shabbos. All the 39 melachot, and this gets us back to what Rabbi Shimon was protesting. Shabbos is the day that we stop engaging in chaye sha'a. We stopped producing through Chaye Shaha. Those things that Rabbi Akiva, that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was protesting against when he came out of the cave, he saw people planting, he saw people plowing. Those you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. Those are the first melachot, HaChoresh, VaHaKotzer, VaHaZorea. The things that the Romans did, building bridges and minting coins, Metake Mone. The Takin Mane is an Isser Doraita. It's one of the 39 Milachot. You're not allowed to do it on Shabbos. All those things that the Romans were doing, you're not allowed to do it on Shabbos. You're not allowed to bake bread on Shabbos. The thing that his wife baked for him and brought to him to feed him. Not allowed to do that on Shabbos. Shabbos is out of time. It's completely separate. It's an abrupt cessation of everything that makes the week the week. So Shabbos is what we call Mayin Olam Haba, right? It's otherworldly. Like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's cave, we have our cave, and it's called Shabbos. But at the same time, Shabbos is supposed to infuse the week. And this takes us to a Gemara in Beitza, right, that talks about Hillel and Shammai, that Shammai, in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Zachor at Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho, every day he would go out to the street, he would fulfill the mitzvah of Zachor et Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho by looking to see if, to buy a good piece of meat on Shabbos, for Shabbos, L'Chavad Shabbos. So he would go out on Sunday and he would find a nice, good steak and he said, oh, this is for Shabbos. And then Monday he would go out and he would say like, oh, this steak that I see today, is this better than the one that I saw yesterday or not? I call it, it's like living a life like an optometrist, right? Is this better or is this? Is this better or is this? Right? Every time he goes out, he's constantly evaluating, and I think that that's a key to Shammai's personality. And in fact, the word Shammai in modern Hebrew means assessor, someone who's constantly evaluating, who's constantly measuring. So that's what Shammai is doing. But that's how he fulfills the mitzvah of Zachor Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho. He's constantly evaluating, assessing, is this better for Shabbos or is this? Is this better for Shabbos? Can I enhance my Shabbos by buying this or not? Ramban talks about how, you know how we call the week Shabbos, and we call the first day as Yom Rishon L'Shabbat, Yom Sheni l'Shabbat. That itself is a kiyum, is a fulfillment of Zachorat Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. We use Shabbos as the fulcrum, as the central point of the entire week. We build our whole week around Shabbat. In which case, you know, we prepare food on the during the week. We prepare food. That's Chayei Shav. We prepare food for Shabbat. We make or we buy nice clothes. That's Chayei Shav. But we buy clothes L'chavad Shabbos. So all of these things that we do during the week to prepare for Shabbos, they're all Chayei Shav, but they're all part of Zohar Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho. And in this sense, Shabbos is very, very much a part of the week. It's the part of the week to which the rest of the week surrounds. It revolves around. So Shabbos lives in this paradox between being part of the week and not being part of the week. And what time symbolizes this more than anything else? Bein HaShmashos. Bein HaShmashos on Erev Shabbos, as the week gives way to Shabbos. At a certain point, maybe at one moment, there's actually a machloket about Bein HaShmashot, and one of the three people who discuss, I just realized this now, the three people who discuss what Bein HaShmashot is, it's Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Shimon, who the three principals of our Gemara. But Bein HaShmashot, as the week gives way to Shabbos, it's a time that's both time and not time. It's part of the week and not part of the week. It's literally living on the tether between the temple, the temporal, and the eternal. And that's also the paradox of an old man running. Old man running, that's something youthful. But in an old man, is he old? In which case he wouldn't be running. Or is he running, in which case you would expect him to be young? An old man running. And Rabbi Shimon asks him, it's jarring. He's looking at this man. And this man, the Gemara itself says, symbolizes all of Klal Yisrael. Right? Because Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says about this old man, Chazi kama chavivin mitzvot al Yisrael. This person, he extrapolates from this old man to the rest of Israel. Maybe it was just this one guy who does this, who has two myrtle branches on Erev Shabbat. No, he's representative of all Klal Yisrael. I would say that he even is a symbol of all of Klal Yisrael. What is the Jewish people if not an old man running? Right, the name of this project is Torah in Motion. Right? Torah is something ancient. Motion is something now, is something vibrant. And it brings forth this quote from Mark Twain, what Mark Twain said concerning the Jew, and he actually says the Jew versus the Roman and other empires. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? Yes, what is the secret of his immortality? And this Gemara seems to be saying the secret of his immortality is the same secret that makes Shabbos Shabbos. That at the same time, you're both in time and you're out of time. You transcend time, but you're also part of time. You're part of history, but you're also not part of history. You're an old man, but you're running. You're Chaye Olam, your eternal life, but you're also Chaye Sha'a. You're also living in the present, in the here and in the now. And then there's the spices. The spices also, the sense of smell is the most sublime of all of our senses. It's something that also lives on the edge, at the margin, where the physical gives way to the spiritual, where something of this world gives way to something from another world. And that's why we have Besamim on Motzei Shabbat, to carry Shabbos over into the rest of the week, to take the otherworldliness of Shabbos with us into the week. I mentioned that I think that this symbol of the old man running, this scene with the old man running, is the central symbol to this whole thing. I think this is where the transformation really happens. I think this is where Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai finally learns a lesson that he's now able to go back to society and implement. And I think that it's also, it's something that we can take away from. It's something that we can look at and say, ah, this is something that is a key lesson, a core lesson of Jewish history and of what it means to be Jewish. It means to be living in time and living out of time all at once, which is something that the mind can't grasp and the ear can't hear and the mouth can't utter, just like Zohar v'Shamor. It lives on both sides of this paradox, in the present and eternal, all at the same time. Shomar Rabbi Pinchas ben Ya'ir Chotnei. Rabbi Pinchas ben Ya'ir, the son-in-law of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, heard v'nafal kla'apei, and he went out to greet him. Now, Rabbi Pinchas ben Ya'ir, the son-in-law of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, he has a reputation for being a miracle worker. And it's interesting that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai also develops a reputation as a miracle worker, but in our Gemara, there's nothing of, we'll see that there is one miracle that happens to Rashbi, but it's not the kind of miracle that we're expecting. Not the kind of miracle that you would expect from a miracle worker. I mean, we saw miracles happen to him, just like a tree growing up overnight, but he doesn't perform miracles. He's not a wonder worker. Rabbi Pinchas ben Ya'ir comes to greet his father-in-law. Ayi lebei banya. He took him to the bathhouse. Have a ka'arech lebisrei. And he was massaging his skin. Now, bathhouses, that's one of the places that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai criticized at the beginning. It was only there. It's only there for them to pamper themselves. And now he comes back to society. Where's the first place he goes? He goes to the bathhouse. So one might think that, you see, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, he changed his opinion. He is no longer what he was. He has embraced the bathhouse. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is now modern Orthodox. God forbid. Well, maybe. Let's go on. Ka'arach Leila Bisra, they were massaging his skin. You're talking about a guy who was living basically up to his neck in sand for the last 13 years. So he probably could have used a little bit of moisturizer. Chazi dehava bepili begufe. They saw that he had cracks, clefts in his body. Have a kabachi. He was crying. Kanatru dimot eme v'kametzavchale. And the tears were streaming from Rabbi Pinchas ben Ya'ir's eyes. And they were causing more pain than the actual, you know, wounded skin. You know, it was the tears. He was pouring salt on wounds. And he says, Amarlo oilo shri ticha bakach, woe to me that I see you in such a state. And he's thinking, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, this poor guy, he's just been hiding. He's been in a cave for the last 13 years. He's been in hiding. And this is the result. Oh, it's terrible. Amarlo Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says, no, don't worry about me. Ashrecha sher itani b'kach. It's good that you see me like this. Because had you not seen me like this, amarlo itani b'kach, lo matzata b'kach. You know, this is a small price to pay for what I've gained. What did he gain? To me, ikara ki have a makshi Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai kushya. Whenever Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai had a question, Rabbi Pinchas ben Ya'ir trace our piruki. Rabbi Pinchas ben Ya'ir would give 12 answers. But after the 12 years or the 12 years and the 12 months in the cave, Kavam Makshir Rabbi Pinchas ben Ya'ir Kushio, when Rabbi Pinchas ben Ya'ir would ask a question, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, Esrin ba'arba piruki. He would give 24 answers. Right, so these numbers, 12 and 24, they recur. We saw it with Rabbi Akiva also, 12,000 pairs, 24,000 students. Here you have 12 questions, a question with 12 answers, a question with 24 answers, 12 years in a cave, and another 12 months in the cave. So you see that these are numbers that are drawing our attention. And here it's saying that the 12 years and the 12 months in the cave are what gave us, or what gave Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, the ability to take something where he would once ask a question and get 24 and get 12 answers, where now he can offer 24 answers. But this also reinforces this notion that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, it's the cave that made Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. It's the cave that made him, the Torah that he studied in the cave was something that made him him. And we alluded to that a little bit last week, but that's what, the idea that the Zohar came from his 12 years in the cave. I think that we talked about the disembodied Torah. We talked about a Torah that's not connected to this world. I think that's part of what's going on here. You have a much more whole view of the Torah, a much more abstract view of the Torah. You're able to look at it from that many more different angles. And so every question can have 24 answers. Omar, so Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai said, Hoyl v'itrachish nisa ezel itkin milta. Since a miracle happened, and what's the miracle? It's hard to know, either that he was saved or possibly that he was able to grow so much in learning, right? His Torah is that much more impressive after these 13 years than it was before. But he says, you know what? I'm going to do something good for society now. And now he takes his paradigm. He takes his cue from Yaakov Avinu. Dichtiv, right? The Gemara is interjecting this, but it's interjecting this as though this is what Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is thinking to himself. It says, Vayavo Yaakov Shalem, Yaakov came whole, complete, to the city of Shechem. After all these years, after his confrontation with Lavan, after having fled from his father's house, after having fled from Esav, after having encountered Esav again, he now comes to complete, whole. He comes back to Shechem. He comes back to Shechem and he's whole. What does that mean that he's whole? Omar Rav. So Rav answers, Shalem begufo. He was whole of body. He was uninjured. Shalem b'mamono, he was monetarily, fiscally, economically unimpaired, meaning he still had his money with him. And shalem b'torato, he hadn't forgotten his Torah. Okay, I just received a comment that somebody can't hear. Is that, can people hear? Can you give a little
I can hear you
thumbs
fine.
Up?
I can hear you fine. Yeah, I don't know. It must be something with the personal computer.
Okay, that's fine. Okay. Shalem Torato. So he was shalem. He was whole in all of these different dimensions: his body and his finances and his Torah. And Rav Kook points out here that these are all complementary. You can't really be shalem begufa, shalem beguf, unless you're also shalem b'mamon and shalem b'torah, etc. These are all different types of shlemut that all fit together, that you can't be shalem with anything unless you're shalem with everything. It's a nice idea. Vayichan et p'nei ha'ir. So he goes and he encamps. Vayichan is interpreted here as not just that he encamped facing the city, but Vayichan, he gave chen, he graced the city with his presence. How did Yaakov Avinu grace the city of Shechem with his presence? Amar Rav, Rav says, matbea tiken lahem. He minted a coin. Shmuel Amar, shvakim tiken lahem. he established marketplaces. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Merchatzot Tikein Lahem. He established bathhouses. Two out of the three things here are things that he was originally criticizing, the Merchatzot and the Shvakim. The third one, which was the bridges, well, according to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the only reason that you had bridges was in order to, so that the Romans could take our money. And here you have the money, the matbea. Rav says that Yaakov Avinu graced the city of Shechem by minting coins. What happens next in this story? The Gemara doesn't say what happens next in the story of Yaakov Avinu and Shechem. We know what happens, though. What's the next part of the story? You can answer in the chat. The Dina story. And what happens after the Dina story, after Dina is taken and raped by Shechem? Yaakov's sons go out and massacre the entire city of Shechem. So great job, Yaakov. That's so great. Wow, you minted a coin for them. You built a bathhouse for them. You even set up a marketplace for them. That's so great. That was so nice of you to do that exactly 1 week after you murdered every man, woman, and child in the entire city. What's it going for here? And Rabbi Shimon is using that as his paradigm. Oh, I'm going to go do something for the benefit of society, just like Yaakov Avinu did a week before his kids massacred the place. What's going on? Why are we using this as your paradigm? And again, we see once again the Gemara is constructed as a pastiche, right? We saw it here. The Zohar and Shamor you're bringing in from someplace else from the Gemara and Shavuot. Here, you're bringing the story of Yaakov. It's bringing the story of Yaakov and Dina in from, it's doing a copy paste, in from Sefer Bereishit. And it has these drashot of these wonderful things that Yaakov did. And it's telling us, read that whole story. You need to know what's going on in that whole story in order to understand what's going on here. Yaakov comes and he establishes, Yaakov comes to Shechem, having returned to Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Kena'an, in fulfillment of a promise that he made to Hashem, and in fulfillment of a promise that Hashem made to him. Hashem had promised Yaakov Eretz Yisrael. Eventually, Yaakov knew he was going to, the land was going to be his. So Yaakov comes, he comes to the city of Shechem. And Yaakov could have thought, hey, God promised me this land. I don't need to do anything for you people. I don't have to answer to you. It's my land. I'm going to be here. And if you don't like it, we're happy to fight a war against you. Yaakov, he looks at the people of Shechem, and not only does he let them live, but he also, he does something nice for them. He mints coins, he establishes bathhouses, he improves their society. Now, things turn south there, and somebody, Zahav iPad, pointed out, Yaakov was not happy with his sons. And that's true. He was not happy with his sons. Yaakov says, what's going to happen now? All these different tribes are going to gang up on us. You totally dropped that. You should not have massacred them. But be that as it may, Yaakov never says to Shimon and Levi, you know, they didn't deserve it. They didn't deserve to die. He doesn't say that. His concerns are real political. Everybody's going to gang us up on us. What are you doing to my reputation? What are people going to think of us? And he saves more fire for later when he's on his deathbed and he curses Shimon and Levi. So it's a difficult thing to manage here. It's a tightrope here. On one hand, Yaakov knows that this is not how it's supposed to be. In the future, we know it's going to be different. We will be in control in this land. We are going to inherit this land. God promised it to us. But for now, we can make nice. We can help. We can even help them improve their society. We can participate in their society, and we can even help them improve it. We can do nice things for them. And I don't want to say anything too overtly political here about the modern state of Israel, but you can draw your own conclusions. Yes, it's our land, but one day God's promises to us will be fulfilled. I don't know if that is going to come to fruition next week, as Shimon and Levi made it happen, or if it'll be in 5 years or 10 years or 400 years. Eventually it'll happen. But it's not going to happen today. And since it's not going to happen today, I can contribute something to your society. And this is exactly what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is now thinking about Rome. Okay, I'm coming to Rome. Rome is in charge now. The Romans are here to stay. They're entrenched. They beat us bad. So how am I going to relate to them? Well, I have a promise from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we are going to control Eretz Yisrael. And it's a promise. And God's promises are never broken. But I don't know when the fulfillment of that promise is going to be. So in the meantime, I am going to do nice things for society. I am going to improve society. I'm going to make society more hospitable for me and for people like me. Someday there will be an opportunity to change this. To change the dynamic. Someday there will be an opportunity to rid this country of Roman rule. I don't know if it's going to be in 2 years or in 5 years or in 1800 years. Someday it will happen. We are an old man running. We have time. Eventually it will happen. And when it does happen, we'll be here waiting and ready. And so I think that's really what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is teaching us, what he learned in the years in the cave, and what he teaches us about going into Golus, going into a world where you're no longer your own Baal HaBayit, you're no longer in control of your own destiny. This is the change. At the beginning, we said that you had Rabbi Yehuda, who was the accommodator, and you had Rabbi Shimon, who was the resistor. He's resistant. And Rabbi Yossi, who was the one whose strategy was a strategy of silence. Don't say anything. And here, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is giving us a fourth approach. And the fourth approach is we wait. What's our strategy? While we're in this inhospitable culture, we live in the present, we contribute what we can, and we wait, and we wait, and we bide our time. Rashbi learned patience. He learned not to protest, to swallow his criticisms of Rome, to change what he can, and to wait, to hold out for something else for the future. So then Rashbi goes and he makes a tikkun. What is he mitakein? He says to everybody, is there something that needs to be fixed? Amrule, they said to him, there's a place that has a suffik tuma. There's a field of some sort that there might be Tuma there. We're not sure. And the halacha is, this is called a Beit HaPras, a field in which a human bone was found. And so the halacha is that we have to treat the entire field as though it's tamei. Ve'itlehu tzara lekohanim la'akufe, and there's pain. It's torment. It's really inconvenient for the kohanim who are not allowed to become tamei mate to walk all the way around. So Omar, so he said, is there anybody that knows whether or not this place was ever once considered tahor? So now it's tamei. But did it have a prior chazaka of tahara? Does anybody remember whether this was once tahor? Amar le hahu saba. So now an old man, a different old man, said, kan kitzes ben zakai turmas e truma. Here, Ben Zakkai cut down lupines that were truma, and he treated them as tahor. Truma has to remain tahor. So you say that there was a chazaka that this place was tameh. So avad ihu nami hachi. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai did the same. He started harvesting lupine beans from this field. Kol hechadahav kashi. Wherever the ground was hard, tahare. He said, this is tahar. You're allowed to walk here. V'chol hecha tahava rafi, but wherever the ground was soft, tzayene, he marked it off as being someplace where Kohanim couldn't go. So first of all, there were three places that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai picked on at the beginning. There were markets, and we saw that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, he mentions markets as, we invoked the markets already, and we invoked the bathhouses already. The one place that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai hasn't returned to, and Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is going to go back to the, is going to go out to the street in just a few lines. So he goes to the bathhouse, he goes to the street. The one place he doesn't go is to a bridge. But I would argue that he doesn't have to go to a bridge. Why? Because he makes a bridge. He builds a bridge. What is this if not a bridge? A bridge is something that connects point A to point B where you can't really go around otherwise. You have to cross a river. How are you going to cross the river if there's no bridge over it? You're going to cross the train tracks. You can go all the way around or you can build a way over it. What does Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai do here? He builds a bridge to make it possible to cross from one end of this field to the other end. But I think there's more going on here. When he says that he's going to be metaken something, and again, that's what the Romans did at the beginning, that they were metaken things. They build things. They make things. I'm also going to make something. But Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai making something, this is what it means when rabbis make things, right? I remember when I got to one of my first rabbinic jobs before Aliyah, one of my only rabbinic jobs before Aliyah, we built an Eruv. Right? Did I build any walls? Did I build any markets or bridges or bathhouses? No, I strung an invisible wire up and I put a bunch of poles on posts, on electrical poles. That's building? So yes, that's how rabbis built. This is how rabbis build. Rabbis build in ways that make life easier, more accommodating for the way that they want to live, the way that they need to live. They find a way forward for their people, for their constituents, to allow their constituents to live in a ready-made world. I mean, I didn't go and build a city. The city was there. I was mitaking something so that there would be an Eruv. Here, there's something there. There's a city there. And Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai wants to make it more hospitable, wants to make this Roman city more hospitable to the way that we live. There are two other things that are going on here, two other layers with this, a path through the graveyard. And this is where I get the title for this shiur. One is that in order to move forward, you need to be able to The first thing you need to be able to do is bury the dead. Hatova HaMeitiv, we saw at the beginning of this series, Tova HaMeitiv was a bracha that was created to mark the fact that we were allowed to bury the dead of Beitar, because you can't move forward until you've buried the dead. The Kleisenberger Rebbe, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, he's well known for having created all kinds of institutions of Jewish learning in the DP camps in the years following the Holocaust. He created a Chassidus out of nothing. He attracted to himself a lot of the homeless and orphaned Chassidim. He was one of the only Rebbes to undergo, to have lived through the camps and survive. He lost his entire family of 10 children, his wife and 10 children, his first wife and 10 children perished in the Holocaust. And he himself was in Auschwitz and several other camps. And he survived. And a lot of the Hasidim that survived, whose Rebbes had either gotten out early enough or whose Rebbes had perished, were attracted to him because he knew their pain. He had gone through what they had gone through. After the war, the first thing that the Kleisenberger Rebbe did, he didn't start building institutions right away. He didn't start building yeshivas, and he didn't start building Beis Yaakovs and seminaries and building mikvaos. He did that, but it wasn't the first thing he did. The first thing he did after the war was he put in a request to the U.S. Army, which he was in the American zone. He put in a request for a car and the driver, and they went around to the camps in the area that he was in the American zone, burying the Jewish dead. So that in order to rebuild life, you have to remember that life is worth something. You have to reaffirm life. And one of the ways to reaffirm life is to give dignity to the dead, to mark the dead, to give the dead a proper burial. So here's a field in the middle of whatever city. According to the Yerushalmi, it's Tveria. We don't know how many people are buried here. We don't know how many graves there are. In recent memory, it was Tahor. What is this? Is this some kind of mass grave from the time of Bar Kokhba? Is this some place where the Jewish dead were dumped and it wasn't even marked? If we want to recreate life, if we want to find a way to go forward, we need to mark off, we need to give these people proper burials. We need to mark off their graves. And then we need to find a way forward in between and through the graves. And I think that's the image of a path through the graveyard. That's the image of building a bridge through the graveyard. We need to move forward. And this is, he's living in a time that was, it was cataclysmic. The debacle of Bar Kokhba, I think that in Jewish history, really, it compares with the Holocaust in terms of the number of dead and the absolute, like just the sense of just being absolutely crushed afterwards, the sense of can life even go on? And it falls to Rabbi Shimon and the people of his generation to chart that way forward, to chart a path through the graves. I think that that's another level of what's going on with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai finding a way to be metaher this graveyard. Amar Hahu Saba. That old man then says to Rashbi, Tiher ben Yochai beis hakvaros, Bar Yochai purified a cemetery. What are you, reform? They say in Israel today. Does it follow me? It's like, what are you trying to do? What are you? You're just neglecting halacha? We treated this whole thing for the last several generations since the time of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. We've treated this as a graveyard, and now you're going to come along and be metaher it? Amar lo, so Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says to him, Ilmalei hayita imanu, filu hayita imanu velo nirneti imanu. Had you not been here, well, we discussed this, or even if you had been here, but you hadn't raised your voice, Yofa Ata Omer, I accept what you're saying. Tradition, But you were part of the discussion. And we reached a decision together. Yomru, they're going to say, Zonot mefarkesot zu et zu. Even whores apply makeup to one another. Meaning, whores, you would imagine that they're in competition with one another. But they still want each other to look good. They don't want the market to dry up. They understand that as much as their competition is their enemy, their competition is also, they want their competition to be good enough to drive up demand. And Talmidei Chachamim, what about Talmidei Chachamim? So it's true, every posek wants people to ask their shaylos, wants people to ask them shaylos. They don't want them to ask shaylos to the other guy, chas v'shalom. What are you going to do? You're going to denigrate the other guy and say, you can't listen to that guy. That guy is blah, 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 blah. What's going to happen? People are going to learn that, like, okay, I don't want to deal with rabbis at all. I don't want to, why should I listen to any rabbi? And this is a little bit different from what we saw Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai saying at the beginning, where Rabbi Shimon was, Rabbi Shimon, if you recall, was the one who publicly disagreed with the other rabbis, and it became known to the Romans. What are people going to say? I think that the old man here, as opposed to the other old man, this old man is, in a sense, Rashbi's old self. That this is Rashbi dealing with his old self. Rashbi's old self, we pointed out earlier that Rashbi, he was disconnected from the present. And it wasn't just because of Roman culture that he was disconnected from. He was disconnected from Roman culture, but he was even disconnected from the peasant farmer who's working, who's working his land. I apologize. Okay. Lost track of time. I will, 3 more minutes. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's old self is all about past with no present. And now he confronts that old man, the old man who says, this is what it was in the past. You can't change it in the present. And he says, he looks at him, v'noch nafshe. He kills off that old man, that old self of his. And then what happens? So he kills off the present. He kills off the past that has no present. But then he goes out into the market. And here we have the third place that he initially criticized. He goes back, he goes out to the market. Chazielu Yehuda ben Gerim, and he sees Yehuda ben Gerim, the person who he said represents a Jewish present with no Jewish past. Amar Adayin Yesh Lezeba Olam, this guy's still around. Yahav Natan Bo Einav, he looks at him, Ba'asahu Gal Shalat Samar, and he turned him into a heap of bones. So I think the heap of bones here is saying that something, a heap of bones is, it has no life. It's dry, it's perfunctory, it's skeletal. Contemporary life that has a Jewish form but no Jewish past is a skeleton. Moses Hess uses this metaphor of in his Roman Jerusalem, Moses Hess, I should have brought the passage, talks about contemporary Judaism as a skeleton compared to with the Jewish past. And I think that whether intentionally or not, he's linking, right? He comes up on something with that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is saying here with respect to Rabbi Yehuda ben Gerim, right? That you can't have a present without a past. It's disconnected to its source of life. And all you have is, it's the same in form. It's the same in structure. It has the same skeleton, but it's not the same thing. These two protests, right? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai killing off, on one hand, his old self, who was present, who has a past without a present, and also Yehuda ben Gerim, who's a present without a past, comport with what we saw and what what I suggested was the way forward that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai shows us. That he goes in and he participates in contemporary life. He doesn't oppose it. He doesn't protest it. But he's patient. He's not giving up the past in favor of the present, but he's also not disconnecting from the present anymore. He lives life, but he lives life abnormally. And I think that that's what it means to be a Jew, or to be a Jew in this world. You could say that. Do you want to withdraw from life? No, we don't want to withdraw from life. Do we want to live life normally? No, we don't live life normally. We live life abnormally. We live life in a perpetual state of waiting. We might know that it's not going to end today. It could be a while, but that doesn't, but every day we need to be waiting. Every day we need to be living our lives as though the opportunity for the world to be different exists, is out there. And it will one day come to fruition. It's not going to be today. For today, we're going to live life in the world that we have, but we're never going to lose sight of what the world can be and what the world ought to be. Thank you very much. Have a meaningful Shavuot and a meaningful Yom Tov. I hope you enjoyed the